Welcome back to Level 20. I'm Connor Smith, Level 1 summer intern. This week, I'll be talking with Josh Berman about Level 1's second movie, Second Generation. The movie is free to watch on the Level 1 website this week when the podcast came out, so go watch it if you haven't already. I got a couple quick notes for you about this episode. If you hear some clicking in the background, that's the Level 1 servers running. Friedel understandably did not want to stop working while we recorded this episode. So if it annoys you, just know that that's the sound of the new movie getting made. Friedel will be joining us after this episode, so it won't be a problem in the future. Derek Click and Yoon Olsen share a segment in this movie. I got confused and I asked Berman a question about a rail that Derek hit that I thought was Yoon. My bad on that. And if you're looking for the rail that we're talking about, it's in Derek's part for sure. One other correction, we talked about the trailer song for this movie, and Berman got the Strike 3 and Second Gen trailers confused, so it's a different Wu-Tang track that he names. It's the one you're listening to right now. And last thing, if you have questions for Josh or Friedel that you want to hear answered on the pod, send them in via email to podcast@level1productions.com. Thank you for listening, and here's episode 2 of Level 20, Second Generation. In another life, if you're not making movies, what's Josh Berman doing?
Way back in the day, I aspired to be an architect when I was a little kid. I thought that's what I wanted to do.
Dope.
Then I actually went to
random
college. Yeah. No, architecture and design. And
kind of ended up doing that.
It's funny because not that I was the architect on this building.
Right.
But I do remember drawing a house plan when I was a little kid that had a big like tower in the middle, stairwell tower that doesn't look too much different than what we've got here in 916, which is pretty funny. I did, however, go to college pre-med biochem double major because I was going to be an orthopedic surgeon. So that wasn't even like another life ago. That was still this life just a long time ago. But I'm glad I didn't do that.
Yeah, me too.
Yeah. No doubt. Things would have been a lot different if I went down that path.
There's many doctors in the world. There are not a lot of independent ski movie companies.
No, sir. And I wonder if there was no Level 1, would there have been another company that filled that role, or would it have just gone on without somebody fulfilling this kind of role? Good question.
Yeah. What role? Well, let's talk about it then. Second Generation, second Level 1 movie, came out in fall of 2001.
Yes, it did.
Sweet. What role was that filling as the second Level 1 movie?
At that point, I don't think we were really filling any kind of role. For the greater good, it was really just still me cruising around with my group of friends shooting them skiing, and that was kind of all there was to it. We definitely weren't making some great contribution, at least at the time, I don't think. Maybe just on a local, regional level.
Sure.
But even though we were selling copies around the world, but I still think that we weren't, I don't know, making an impact that we would go on to make in later years.
Mm-hmm. And sometimes your friends were filming you every once in a while.
Every once in a while. So again, fall of 2000, I just finished up Balance. I think I finally sent out the master sometime at the end of October, maybe in the beginning of November.
Mm-hmm.
Like it was that late, to the point where all of a sudden it starts snowing and it's like, well, yeah, we're going to make another movie because I think I want to take another winter off from school. I don't want to go back. So that means we make another ski movie. Okay, cool. Let's do it. My knee had not really healed, and I definitely had some loose cartilage floating around. I think it was still another year before I had a follow-up surgery and had a bunch of cartilage chunks pulled out. But at that point, my knee was nowhere close to 100%. It never got to that point, unfortunately. Mm-hmm. But it was good enough that I wasn't jumping, but I was skiing comfortably and felt like I could get on some rails here and there because, it was something that was definitely of interest, and I thought I could actually hang, and maybe I could a little bit with, I guess I could kind of hang with what was going on at the time.
Right.
So I think you're pointing to the closing shot of the intro segment.
Right, the closer. Let's say Bergman gave himself the closer in his opening segment for the second movie, where you slide like a 40-foot down rail.
Yeah, it's probably like 40, 50 feet.
And then jump and smash a sapling.
Yep.
Smash it over. And it's pretty freaking hilarious, even if you don't know that it's the director of the movie doing it. What was your homie's reaction to you lacing that up?
Well, so we showed up to I think it was probably a 4 or 5 day shoot up in Sugarloaf, Maine. And again, Jeff Winterton had put that together. I think that was for another Freeze Mountain of the Month article that he had lined up, and showed up with a couple folks from Southern Vermont, Andy Cantor, Derek Click, and I forget who else was with us at the time, Rory Will. Anyway, so we show up and nobody wanted to actually slide this rail. The mountain had given us permission to slide, so we were all hyped and, I mean, natural in run because we didn't know how to get speed anyway. Mm-hmm. So the deck was stacked and we like start setting this thing up and it's go time and nobody wants to slide it. And it's like, well, fuck, I'll slide it. Jeff Winterton wants to take some pictures. Like, sure, why not? And I guess I was the first person to lace it and came off the end. And I was borderline surprised at that point. And I think very excited, a little adrenaline rush, and ended up like airing off this little snowbank and just like karate kicking a tree. I didn't think I was gonna like actually snap it like a twig, but that's what happened. And Rory Will, I think, got the video shot.
Sick.
From the balcony of the base launch looking down, and that photo, or the photo that Jeff Winterton got of me, ended up being a 2-page spread in Freeze magazine. As an opener for some East Coast profile, and I think there was text on the photo that said East Coast is wicked mint or something.
Wicked pissa.
Yep, that too. But yeah, I mean, that was probably the last season that I was not trying to be an athlete, but was skiing a little bit on what I thought was a level that was worthy of filming. I could keep up with, especially because I was not 100%, not at all.
And also because you were driving it progressing, it would seem, from a ton of the urban content that's in the movie, which is definitely on another level than the rails that are in Balance.
Oh, yeah.
A ton more actual urban rails.
Sure.
And the first thing that jumped out at me is, in that opening segment that we're talking about, there's a shot, I believe, of Candide at Rail Gardens.
Yes.
When was the first time you went there, and what was Rail Gardens like going to that spot when it wasn't blown out like it is now? I don't know if blown out's a word, but...
Yeah, blown out for sure. Well, again, like at that point, people are just kind of figuring out what rail skiing was, and we're definitely looking to snowboarding because they were definitely a solid few years ahead of what was going on in the ski community at that point. And mm-hmm. So I'm assuming that in the Utah scene, people were looking at what JP Walker and Jeremy Jones and a few of these other guys were doing, and Rail Gardens was super easily accessible, had natural speed, the rails were all tiny and manageable, so mm-hmm. some of the people could actually step to while they were figuring out how to slide rails. And so yeah, Rail Gardens was a spot, and I believe we were out there, I guess it was Candide, Mikhail Deschanel, maybe Tanner, I'm trying to remember, but
there's a Max Crusage clip too, I believe, from there. And yeah. Sarah Burke has a clip on a rail from there.
Yes. Some of that footage was probably given to me. I'm trying to remember what I shot. Maybe Mikhail and Candide when I shot with them at Real Gardens. Might have been the next year. But yeah, regardless, I mean, there were definitely a lot of early sessions in the Real Gardens. And, I mean, that was a thing. You just go to the Real Gardens and shoot people doing straight slides and put it in the ski movie. Times have changed. Yeah. Times have changed.
What do you think it means about how far, I don't know, I think it's really cool that there's a legacy to places like that now. It evokes, like, some of what has skateboarding has got going on, like, classic spots in all over California that have been, you know, in movies since the 90s. And sure. Every once in a while, someone will do something different enough that it'll get, that you'll see a clip again from there. Sure. What's that like seeing shit 20 years later from the same place you were going to?
Ah, it's really cool. I think that, I mean, that's one of the interesting things about the sport is just the degree of progression over the past 20 years. So you can actually see it in these almost annual sessions, not even just in our movies, but in just ski media in general. They go down mm-hmm. a lot of these spots. And it's not even specific to just things like Rail Gardens, but there are certainly, you know, a long list of these backcountry gaps, actually in Utah, mm-hmm. that were made famous, you know, right around the time when Level One started, even a little bit before then. And, yeah, I mean, just seeing the degree of progression over the years from, you know, Candide first straight airing Chad's gap, mm-hmm. when it's like, he made it. And like, yeah, that's a make, that's a banger shot to, you know, some people, I don't know if anybody's gotten a real good dub on it yet. I know Dirtchy got like a dub wobble a couple years ago and then ended up in the hospital. So I don't know if that counts. Mm. But regardless, I mean, there's obviously been a lot of stuff that's happened on that, and certainly Pyramid and Flagstaff, Gully mm-hmm. Gap, and, you know, some of these things that have just shown up in so many movies and edits, ski and snowboard over the years, that, I mean, they're kind of like, you know, markers in time of the progression of the sport.
Totally. So Rail Gardens was a great place because, like you said, accessible and not crazy.
Bust.
Right. No bust. And also just like low consequence on the features themselves. In John Olson's segment, there's like a 300-foot down rail that he slides like maybe the first 20 feet of or so. And I believe there's a story behind you guys going to that rail and like a long ways to get to that 300-foot down rail.
Is it you and Olson? Because Derek Click, I watched it the other day. Like, I don't think I ever shot any street stuff with Yoon. Is it Yoon's part? Like, we might be talking about slightly different stories. Well, I will.
You know the rail I'm talking about, at least? Well, let me fill you in on what I listened to your commentary from the DVD.
Okay.
And in it, you talk about it's somewhere in southern Canada, and you went all the way there from Vermont because someone had told you that there's this crazy long down rail.
Sure, you know, this is the one I'm thinking of, but
and you're like,
was,
we're going to go try and maybe slide this whole thing.
Absolutely. So that was myself. It was Derek Click. It was Mike Nick were, I think, the three athletes.
Uh-huh. And how'd it go?
If you want to call me an athlete at that point, maybe
sure.
You're not. But, so, yeah, Jeff Winterton got this hot tip about some rail in St. George, Quebec. And we were staying in Sugarloaf, Maine. And I don't even know, like, who told him or what the deal was. But again, like, keep in mind, like, we're trying to figure out what rail skiing, street skiing even was at that point.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, obviously, we're not stepping to, like, super kink and technical rails. We're looking for, like, mellow down rails, and it's sort of like, how long can we ride a rail for? Like, that's a good way to figure this out. So anyway, we heard about the super long rail in St. George, Quebec. Winterton drives. It's again myself, Mike, Nick, and Derek Click in the back of this car. I know we almost ran out of gas, and I don't remember the resolution to the story, but we're all like absolutely freaked out driving. Winterton's like 88 Subaru station wagon or whatever it was. And anyway, we finally get to this spot, and I want to say it's like 2 or 3 in the morning. I mean, by design, it was the middle of the night, so we thought
sure.
We'd go there and nobody would mess with us. And
mm-hmm.
this rail might have been like 300 feet long, like no joke. I think, maybe I got like 60 feet on it. Derek Click maybe got like 80 feet on it. I don't remember what Mike Nick got, but I do know that he ended up just like having his feet slide out from under him, didn't get his hands down, and went like ass crack first onto this rail and broke his tailbone. That was the beginning and the end of his trip. He ended up going back with us later that night after we just like, you know, floundered on this rail for a few hours and realized that nobody can actually slide a mellow 300 foot basically flat rail. It's right. Not a thing. Cross that off the list and move on. Went back to Sugarloaf, and I feel like we got back at like 8 or 9 in the morning after being up all night. And Mike Nick just got right in his car, drove back to Albany, New York. And I think from what I remember, he told me he had to sit on a donut for like 2 months straight while his tailbone healed.
For not a lot of reward.
No reward. And actually, like, the backside of that is, if I remember correctly, he wasn't even up in Sugarloaf with us. That afternoon, he had driven from Albany to Sugarloaf, jumped in the car, drove all the way up to St. George, Quebec, and basically just did like, you know, 20 hours of driving to break his tailbone. With a pit stop in the middle to, like, yeah, break his tailbone.
Ouch.
Yep. Yep.
So
that was actually, on that note, the story I'll throw in there too, that was one of my first recollections of having met Friedel Cody.
Oh.
I know the first time we officially crossed paths, which he remembers more vividly than I do, was in the Mount Snow parking lot, I guess, when I sold him a copy of Balance on VHS. But yeah, he showed up to this shoot in Sugarloaf, I think with his brother. And I remember him drinking, he was like 16 years old, drinking like a case of beer and passing out under the table. And that's one of my early memories of Friedel.
It's a good one.
It's a great one. Anyway,
I was gonna, so, like, speaking of pushing the limits maybe a bit too far, there's Scott Hibbert has a really sick segment, and there's a pow gap in it that makes a couple appearances in the movie, I believe at Killington.
Sure, right outside of Killington.
And he goes for a nutty dub on that. Give me, what's the backstory to that gap first, and then him pushing the limits with that dub on it?
Well, the Killington Road gap, as I think we just called it, was a jump or a jump spot that Jeff Winterton found a couple years before. I think he might have initially shot some photos even before he brought us to go hit it.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, it's a sketchy East Coast road gap in every sense of the word, but it definitely had a takeoff and a landing, and we went back there on several occasions. And you know, for us at the time, I mean, that was a huge undertaking, and it was really, you know, pushing the limits of what we were doing. And Hibbert, I think Hibbert really sums it up best in his interview in Balance, the first movie, where he says, "I just turn my brain off and like huck myself," or something to that yeah. extent. And I think that that's kind of the prevailing attitude that he had for a lot of this stuff. And sometimes it worked, sometimes it didn't. That time it definitely did not work.
No.
And yeah, I was just gearing himself up for crash segments to come.
When you say that was just a big undertaking for you at the time, what were those challenges like? How was it at the first couple of times you're like stacking up a lip and like trying to get someone to guinea a big gap that they might not have, or some, you know,
sure,
people are trying to talk themselves into it, but
absolutely. Well, for one, I'll point out that as a filmmaker, I think there are a few different approaches that people have. And I've actually heard of other filmmakers that have really pressured and pushed athletes to do stuff. And I'll tell you, coming from my experiences as, you know, at least a competitive mogul skier and aspiring professional free skier, to the point where, like, I understood the risks. I knew what scared the shit out of me. And I also knew that I never wanted anybody telling me what to do. And so that was always really important to me as a filmmaker, to never, ever push my athletes to do something that I thought was risky. Everything was always on their own terms. I think more than anything else over the years, I've told people to take a step back and to not hit something. And I've tried to be the voice of reason when I thought that something was not worth the risk.
When Scott Hibbert's turning his brain off. Or ex-athlete.
Exactly. Like, Hibbert, don't flip that switch.
Yeah.
Keep that brain on. No, I think everything was a little loose at that point. But I will point out, definitely that's something that's always meant a lot to me, that safety and coming home at the end of the day without broken bones and or worse is the most important thing. Like, bar none. And I'll tell you, I know stories of other filmmakers that have just like pressured athletes to do shit and put them in uncomfortable situations, and there have been some really bad results from that kind of attitude. And you know, these people are my friends, and there's no shot that's worth an injury.
Sure, I like that.
It's true. Important.
Other POW jumps that like really caught my eye. There's a Mark Bellevue POW jump, a step up. Were you at that session?
I was not. I think we're talking about Flagstaff Gully Gap.
Okay.
I'm trying to remember who shot all that stuff. That might have even been Steve Rosendahl from Blue Ribbon Productions, who I had befriended at that point. But I mean, that probably would make the most sense because I know Bellevue was hanging out with those guys in Utah. And that was probably a situation where at the end of the season, I was like, oh man, I get you some more shots. Like, you just sent them to me and I'd hit up Steve and get the green light or something like that. But, I mean, I would say that probably 90% of balance, second generation, I personally shot. And a couple contributors here and there that rounded it out. Sure. But yeah, some of the early POW stuff, especially Max Kujai, you know, some of these guys were shooting in Utah. I mean, that was something that I wasn't really familiar with. Like, I think the jibbier stuff in the backcountry at that point was really, you know, what came from my camera and from my specific crews, because we were treading very lightly at that point. And, I mean, everything was really kind of jump-oriented.
What about the snowmobile toe-in jump? I think in Andy Woods' segment and maybe a few other places it shows up too.
Yeah, so we had a bunch of friends that were living in Park City, Utah at the time. A guy by the name of Ryan Jameson and some of his friends who moved out from southern Vermont were crashing on their couch. And one of them happened to have a snowmobile, so we probably towed a half dozen guys back on the sled to Guardsman's Pass. And, you know, it was one of our early forays into what building a jump in the backcountry was. And, yeah, it's getting really funny to look back and see, you know, what we were doing at the time, especially having shot in Guardsman's Pass in the winter of 2019 and compared, like, what we're doing now to what we're doing then. It's a very funny juxtaposition. But at that point, we're looking for something that vaguely resembled a landing and then, you know, a flat spot to tow people in or something. I mean, there's no real rhyme or reason to it. You know, we're just kind of shooting from the hip. And I mean, it's really hysterical. We're building like little mokel jumps on the side of you know, flat landings. And yeah, it was the very beginning of the progression for sure.
Were you stoked on snowmobiles back then? Were you like, fuck yeah, this dude's got a snowmobile? Were you like,
I think I was probably more intimidated than anything else. Okay. I was just like, you know, I've never really ridden motorcycles, and I'm not like a motorsports dude. So, I mean, it's like, all right, this guy has a snowmobile. But I'll tell you what, very early on, it was clear that if you wanted to pursue that kind of filming, that was the necessary tool. And I think it was probably 2 years later when I bought my first sled and just made that commitment. And there are many funny stories to follow that one for sure.
Sick. Switching gears back to like urban oriented stuff. There's a step up with a car tow in a parking lot that is like pretty sick feature, pretty sketchy feature with the tow in. Like, it looks like you had to mock, and tell me what was the setup there.
So there were a couple of car tow ins in ski resort parking lots that we did for second generation. And one was in Okemo. I think we were up there with Sarah Burke, Rory Will, Max Kujai, Garrett Britton, Scott Hibbert, and Jeff Winterton, and myself. for about a week, 10 days, maybe over the New Year's holiday. And, you know, we were just trying to find different stuff to hit, and there was no blueprint. So, you know, we're looking at parking lots and how do we get speed and hit piles of snow. And somebody came up with the idea of doing a car tow. It's probably Winterton or Rory Will, actually. Mm-hmm. And, yeah, so we built this funky little cheese wedge and came back super late at night and towed these guys through a gravel parking lot with a light dusting of snow on it, probably like 50 miles an hour.
That's a lot of sparks flying.
And that was our first foray into, you know, trying that kind of thing. And I think that just sort of opened our eyes to just the potential to get creative. Like there were no rules. There were wrong ways to do it for sure. But we didn't know them yet. We had to learn those lessons on our own. And we learned those lessons several times over that year. Certainly Squaw Valley parking lot, probably a month later, we were actually all out there for X Games qualifiers, back when you could actually just show up and try to qualify for a spot in the X Games. Just sign your name up on, probably pay your $50 entry fee and get a bid and do it. Yeah. And Squaw Valley hosted the one that year. And staying with Dave Crichton, and I think we're staying in a condo in the village, and both he and I scoped this huge pile of snow that the plow had pushed up that looked like a massive jump. I mean, just coincidental. Mm-hmm. And it happened to be, I don't know, 30, 40 feet away from this concrete stone parking garage building, and there was a flat area on top. And it's like, man, you could actually, like, if you get speed, you could hit that like a real jump and just send it. And so we figured out how to do that and came back a couple nights later, probably like 3 or 4 in the morning, because that's the only way you can do that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And brought a couple of local friends along to help out. And yeah, I mean, it was a lot of fun, but it pretty much totaled the car that we were driving.
Yeah, so like you're like maybe halfway into the session, it feels like, and people are just starting to get the hang of it.
Yeah.
And then there's someone gets a 180, don't know who.
Tony Basile, who is a friend from Mogul Skiing, shows up, and along with the Schrab brothers, there's a very mixed bag of people, and then Crichton. I think those are the only people that wanted to hit it. I assume we probably have like a dozen other homies that were out there, and everybody's like, no thank you, I want nothing to do with that. But
because it's psycho.
It's pretty psycho. Definitely.
Like, you undershoot and you just smash into a brick wall.
Yep.
You overshoot and you also smash into a concrete ledge that's like on this other side of the roof.
Yep. So fortunately, nobody undershot, because that probably would have been the greater of two evils. Crichton overshot and definitely landed a 180 pretty much up against this wall. And I think there was like 2 feet of fresh pow on the roof, so he was okay. Miraculously, but
it doesn't look like he's gonna be okay.
I know.
it's really scary watching.
Yes, it is. But our buddy Tim McKeever, who was originally a mogul skier from Killington back in the day, who I think was living there in Tahoe at the time, he was our stunt driver for the night, driving our friend Rob Martin Falvey's car, his pretty new Jeep Grand Cherokee.
Who was not even there this night? Or
He was there, but I don't think he didn't want to drive. He wanted to watch, maybe, or drink beers, or watch and drink beers.
Yeah.
But anyway, as you can imagine, so the car or the Jeep has to accelerate to like 40, 50 miles an hour. These guys got to whip off the back on the tow rope. And then the Jeep has to very rapidly decelerate. And of course, if you're doing that in a snow-packed parking lot, you're pretty much creating a shiny track in your wake from having the Jeep slam on the brakes and slide through all this stuff. And so, I mean, I didn't realize what was going on, but obviously that outrun is getting sketchier and sketchier and sketchier. And Crichton, I think, was it Crichton or Tony? Somebody hits it, and I'm posted up on the roof. And then in the back of the shot, you just hear, kind of see this, like, it was a collision, and you hear this terrible crunching noise, and the camera tilts up, and then all of a sudden Tim McKeever comes running out of the Jeep screaming, fuck. and the brakes just locked up on the slick spot, and he went right into a front loader that had been parked there to clear the parking lot. And both airbags went off, radiator busted, the whole nine yards. And it was probably, to that point, the most expensive shot that Level 1 had ever gotten. Even though I didn't have to pay for it. Actually, what's really sketchy, I'm pretty positive that those guys drove the vehicle, because it was still drivable, barely, and, like, kind of put it off the road in a ditch down an embankment. And then...
After having already crashed it.
After having crashed it, and then called it in as, like, we went off the road and filed an insurance claim. And yeah, I'm pretty sure that's what actually transpired.
But you didn't pay for it.
But I didn't pay for it. Exactly. Exactly. That was not on me, fortunately.
Was that a wake-up call, how sketchy that was? Or not even a wake-up call, but was it... Like I said, I like watching urban stunts where people go way too crazy, and seeing Dave like 180 into the brick wall like was like puckering.
Yeah, absolutely. But I don't think it was a wake up call, because Dave wasn't sketched and all right. Nobody got hurt, and by all accounts, it was a successful mission. So we're like, all right, we can do this kind of stuff now.
All right,
and. I mean, realistically, I don't feel like we ended up doing too many more things like that. I think we started to wrap our heads around, like, the kind of things that really work and that don't work. But, I mean, that was just kind of, like, fate that this 10-foot-tall ramp had been plowed up
mm-hmm.
in the parking lot right where it was. And we were just so enthused to go do it that that's how it happened.
Fuck yeah.
Yeah.
Dave's first appearance in a Level 1 movie, I don't believe he was in Balance, or at least did not have his own segment.
No. Dave was not in Balance. Dave, at that point, was still competing in moguls and had some crazy relationship with these Japanese companies that were paying him to spend a whole bunch of time over there.
Really?
And, wow. Yeah. And so he was friends with Hibbert and Garrett Britton. I think that was the initial connection, as well as Sarah Burke. Because she came from the mobile skiing community in Ontario. And at the same time, Dave Crichton's older brother, Michael Crichton, not the author, was also a former mobile skier who's really into making ski videos as well. So he was producing some content with those guys. I actually think we ended up using a couple of Michael Crichton's shots of Sarah in her Balance part, like a couple of the night shots, I think, including her first 1080. But anyway, so Crichton was broke onto the scene that year and blew minds, and very quickly made it apparent that he was going to dominate that scene and that sport, and left no question in anybody's mind, I think, by the end of the season that he had arrived.
Totally. And arrived in the movie with the Ender.
Yes.
With a lot of sick... A lot of sick hits.
Absolutely. I mean, he brought a style and a diversity of grabs and rotations and just this, like, ability to go big and match trannies and this combination of skills and, you know, all the things that you want to see that hadn't really been witnessed in the sport yet. And, skip ahead a couple of years, but... You know, I think there was a point in time where Dave was undoubtedly the best halfpipe skier in the world, the best street skier in the world, and the best park skier in the world. Mm. And I will claim that in 2003, Dave was all of those things, which is pretty fucking wild, because you couldn't imagine in 2019 the best halfpipe skier also being the best street skier, let alone being like having the best park game. Like that would never be a thing. I mean, the sport is diversified and specialized so much. But at that point, everybody kind of dabbled in a little bit of everything, and Dave was the best.
Yeah, he has that triple kink at the start of his segment.
Mm-hmm.
This, to me, the gnarliest rail, urban rail in the movie.
Sure.
That's like a preview of what's to come compared to all the other relatively mellow stuff that we've been talking about.
Absolutely. I mean, I think Dave also came from an inline background where, you know, some of the things that he started to step to on skis was just the, you know, why not? Natural progression. Like, this is the kind of stuff I do in the summer. Why wouldn't I do it with skis on my feet? snow's softer than concrete anyway.
That's true.
Most of the time. Most of the time.
Mm-hmm. Matt Sturbins in his segment there is going to some park skiing now, which we've been talking mostly about a couple of other things that have been new for the movie, but there's a really big gap somewhere at Whistler.
Camp of Champions gap. He envisioned that thing all by himself.
Sturbins did?
Sturbins did, absolutely. Wow. And I don't remember the real backstory. I just know that he was the only one that saw it, the only one that wanted to do it. And certainly the only one that did it.
And, it being, it looks like a transfer almost.
It is. He built a cheese wedge on the side of one table or landing and, like, jumped over half the Camp of Champions lane and landed on this little micro chaining that was part of, like, the beginner jumps on the far left. And it was wild. And... you know, again, I think that kind of speaks to what was going on at the time. It's like people didn't know what was and was not possible. So, you know, all of a sudden somebody has some kind of crazy inspiration. It's like, yeah, we're going to try this. Like, it may or may not work. And that one worked.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I think that was very indicative of just what was going on at the time. Nobody really knew.
Hmm.
That and Sturman's had huge balls. Was not afraid of anything.
Yeah. I mean, it would have been sick just to grease that gap, and
yeah,
he got like blunt three,
yeah,
really nice style over the whole thing.
Yeah,
impressive. Wanted to talk about the bail reel because we didn't get to talk about it during Balance in that episode, but there's a sick one in Balance too. This is a sick one in Second Generation that is, yeah, has people slamming left and right just as hard as everyone slams nowadays, even though the tricks maybe aren't the same. What's it like watching that now? And where was the inspiration for putting those reels together?
Sure. So for one, it's pretty obvious, and I've said it before, but everybody was really figuring things out. You know, people are learning tricks for the first time, and you know, the sport is still really in its infancy. And so with all those things going on, everybody's eating shit. a lot. And also people are learning how to fall. I mean, it's kind of an underrated skill, but it is a huge skill nonetheless.
I think so, you really see that. Like, there's people falling in ways that you see, like, not Jerry of the day these days. Like,
Yeah. Some people know how to fall. Some people do not. And it's actually interesting because I think that even translates to a lot of the athletes that we work with in 2019, like, there are some guys that have been around for a decade or more that are still killing it, in part because they know how to fall. And there are people who have been unbelievably talented that were just, like, you know, riding a rocket ship to stardom and just, like, never got there because they don't know how to fall. And the same, you know, way of falling that, you know, the same, like, lack of completion of a trick that would happen to somebody else, they'd end up severely injured. And highly underrated skill set.
Yeah.
For sure. Actually, it's interesting because, you know, we can start to talk about Friedel's little brother, Emil Cody, I think, for strike three is probably the first time he came onto the scene. But, you know, Emil was somebody who not only, I don't even think he knew how to fall as much as he knew how to get off a rail before he ever fell.
Mm.
And so he was able to work through figuring out how to slide rails and was probably one of the better street skiers in the early days because he just would not take a beating. He just knew how to get off a rail. And I mean, even like a preemptive not falling skill set kind of put him ahead.
Sure.
But anyway, sorry. I was just going to say to further answer your question. So crash reels at that point in time in our movies were really inspired. It was they're designed to entertain. I wanted to make a movie, well, for one, that entertained my friends and I. We wanted to see. I mean, that was really the primary goal. And crash reels were a part of it. I mean, obviously, we're generating tons of content of people falling all over the place, and it looks really bad. And segments at the time were, in my mind, not so much to capture the person's season as much as to show, like, this is the action that this person has got going on. And, you know, more than, at least in my mind, the athlete segments didn't have a place for all these crashes. Because they'd probably, you know, outweigh the actual makes in terms of entertainment value. So you had to kind of, like, segment them into something else. And those became the crash reels, and between, again, just trying to create some sort of entertainment and also just being inspired by what else was going on. I feel like a lot of the other ski films and snowboard films also at the time had crash segments, and they were also using really shitty metal music. And I think that's probably why I defaulted to that kind of stuff. It just kind of made sense, and that's what other people were doing. And I felt at that time like I was still kind of following, certainly more than leading, and that's why we've got really, really bad music in a lot of these early movies.
Mm-hmm. The length of Second Generation's a little shorter than Balance, still pretty long for a movie.
Was it like 48, some of them? Yeah.
Compared to an hour plus for Balance.
An hour and change.
Was that conscious choice to make it, to bring it back a little bit? Were you just working with the footage you had? What was your thought process there?
A little bit of both. So it's funny, actually, going into making Balance, my personal goal was to make the longest possible movie that I could.
Mm-hmm.
Which is a really
interesting.
Yeah, I know, right? Which I will say is the only time and place I've ever had that mentality.
Mm-hmm.
So again, at that point, more than anything else, I was a fan of what was going on in the sport and a fan of ski videos. And content was so hard to come by. You literally have to go out and buy a VHS tape. This stuff is not on TV. It's not on the internet, really. I mean, there's no social media. There's no, you know, file sharing as we know it today. People aren't even shooting and recording clips in a way that you can easily get onto a computer. So, I mean, none of that exists. I remember sitting on my dial-up connection through AOL and spending half an hour, maybe an hour, downloading 1, 2, 3 megabyte clips of people skiing moguls. And I'd sit there and wait and wait and wait and wait. And then this, like, horrible, horrible, like, you know, 48p clip comes in. You can barely make out a stick figure skiing moguls. And I thought it was the most amazing thing ever. So if I now have the ability to put all this watchable content on a VHS tape and get it out there, then I'm going to make the longest movie I can.
Hmm.
And it's definitely pretty funny. And actually, like, on that topic, in order to make my shots go as far as possible, another thing we did at the time, or at least I did, was to use the flop feature in Final Cut. So, of course, everything was digital. And for the first time, we had the ability to just drop a filter on, and you could take an image and flip it or rotate it 180 degrees. And, I mean, my goal there was to make the background look different, make a jump look different. So if you have a half dozen shots of an athlete shot from one angle on a jump, and you flop it over, then it looks a little bit different. And the kind of odd byproduct of that, of course, is that everybody that would naturally spin to the left, all of a sudden they're spinning to the right. And the few people like Scott Hibbert who spun to the right are now also spinning to the left. And so in Balance, everybody is spinning natural and unnatural all over the place. And the funny thing is that nobody ever called me out on it. Not the viewers, not the athletes. I mean, nobody ever even thought twice about it, because it wasn't really about like spinning to the left or right. It's just like you're doing it. It's like if you could do a cork 7 at that point, doesn't matter what direction you're spinning. That alone was an accomplishment. Nobody was even thinking of being able to do it both ways.
Damn.
It's pretty funny. But comparing that to Second Generation, you know, watching them both back to back was kind of interesting, because I think Balance was really just made for my friends and I to keep myself busy while I waited for my knee to heal.
Mm-hmm.
Second Generation was the first somewhat intentional movie where we actually went into the season with the goal of making a movie. We had some semblance of a crew and an idea that we wanted to execute on. And I think that allowed us to actually make a movie that in my mind, looking back, made a little more sense. And You know, you could see there's a little bit more design in the shots and in the segments and in the fact that there is an intro and the way segments are structured and the movie flows in general. Again, we're still like really starting to figure that out. But, you know, it was a movie by design, much more so than the first one. That's for sure.
Mm-hmm. When you're getting to the end of it and you realize you've got much more of a movie than you had sure. in that way that you're talking about. Did you really start trying to sell sponsor space to people at that time? Did you do a premiere for it? Like,
all good questions. So I think that the first time we ever did a real premiere was a second generation premiere at UVM in Burlington, Vermont.
Sick.
Yeah. And we had an actual theater. And I remember sitting in the back and basically shaking the whole time.
Oh, yeah?
So nervous.
Wow.
I mean, I didn't think that that's what it would be like going into it. I had no idea, like, what was even going to happen. But, you know, we actually, I'm going to guess we probably had a couple hundred local kids because that was, like, the epicenter of that universe.
Yeah.
And, you know, they all came out for it. Some people would
say it still is, but.
Yeah, well, they all came out for it. And, I didn't even think of what it would be like to share this thing that I spent a year of my life doing with all these people and having them react to it. And of course, you know, in those early days, there were no spoilers. There were no leaks. There was no other way for people to see this. So it was all like the freshest content ever. And, you know, everybody's minds were blown and people were screaming and yelling the whole time. And, you know, by the end of the night, I was like, this is amazing. This is fucking great. We got to do more of this.
Mm.
And I know we definitely did another premiere at Mount Snow that year. Trying to think where else. Maybe we even like licensed it to a couple people out west or something like that. But I mean, that was when I started to wrap my head around what the business side of this would be. And of course, that included trying to figure out how to sell sponsorships. Mm. And thinking out loud, I believe that that was the first year that we had Vocal on board for some form of sponsorship. I think Scott Hibbert was on Vocal. I think Rory Will was on Vocal. A bunch of the crew at that point. And I think I remember going into the Vocal offices in New Hampshire, outside of White River Junction, Vermont, and playing the second generation trailer for them and trying to sell them on it. And mind you, at that point, the second generation trailer was a Wu-Tang track called Shame on a, and I can't say the N-word out loud comfortably in front of people because that would be wrong on many levels, but that's the name of the track. You know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
And and I remember just Vocal skis. Yeah, here's our movie. And and they were into it. They were actually into it. And I'm pretty sure Vocal was our first cash supporting sponsor. And it might have been like $2,000 or something like that, $2,500.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember thinking to myself, I think it was right before we went to Whistler that summer, and I was like, oh my God, like this pays for my entire summer of filming on the glacier.
I'm rich.
I am rich, bitch. Like this is amazing. And I remember thinking that maybe this could all work out, at least for covering expenses. And again, for me at that time, that was a lot of money. I also remember at that point I was starting to sell VHS tapes myself. We didn't have a US distributor. We had a Japanese distributor. I had a European distributor. Yeah, actually Balance, we had a Japanese and a European distributor. There's a company called Champion Visions that did Japanese DVD, or I'm sorry, VHS tape distribution. They were on board super early on with the first movie.
Wow.
Black Diamond Films out of the UK. And VAS, Video Action Sports, was the big distributor of all the action sports stuff in North America. And I remember people just bad-mouthing them all over the place. Like, do not work with them. They will rob you blind. And so I made a very conscious decision at that point to do my own US distribution. So that included me, for one, selling direct through the Level One website at the time, which was a huge challenge because e-commerce platforms were not plug and play. This was a full custom build out, which did not work very well.
Mm-hmm.
And if I remember correctly, like the credit card processing at the time would store the credit card numbers. There's no way to actually run them. So when you place an order, you actually have to put in your credit card and it would sit there in the system. And then I have to go to the bank and get one of those credit card processing boxes, plug it into my phone line. And then months later, when I was done filming and back at the end of the summer, the fall or whatever, I was traveling and sit there and enter all the credit card numbers one at a time.
Wow.
And I actually remember my mom helped me do that one year.
Nice.
Probably for second generation. And
thanks, Mama Berman.
Yep. Thank you, Mama Berman. Corey Vanuler, I'm pretty sure it was second generation that he effectively stole from us, if I remember correctly. I think he was like 13 years old or something like that at CVA. And the credit card expired by the time I went to go run it. And he never emailed back, like despite like 100 emails I sent, like, please send me your credit card. I need your $24.95. And also the other funny thing that was going on at the time, when I finally had all these VHS copies printed out, I'd put all these cardboard boxes in the back of my 84 Volvo station wagon. I would drive all around the Northeast during the fall months, cold calling ski shops. I would just show up, walk in, and ask them to buy my VHS tapes.
What was the success rate on that?
It's pretty low.
Yeah.
Pretty low. It was very degrading, very humbling. Mm-hmm. I don't like sales. Like, I'm not a natural salesperson. Mm-hmm. I don't like to bullshit. I don't like to sweet talk people just for the sake of a buck. Like, it doesn't make me very comfortable. So, I mean, I am uncomfortable to begin with in these environments, and then just like trying to convince these people to buy this movie. And I see it's like, oh, you're carrying Poor Boys movie. Well, we do that too. And like, well, why would we want to carry your movie?
Right. We got the Poor Boys movie.
damn it. That didn't work. But there's a shop in Burlington, Vermont. I'm forgetting the name, but I remember they ordered a bunch of VHS tapes. I remember getting a check for like $300. And that was another, like, probably the first check I ever got from, a shop, and just being like mind blown. I was like, oh my God, $300. Like, this is amazing. And, for like the next 5 or 6 years, we did our own direct distribution. And I had a spreadsheet that I built that probably had, 200, 300, 400 shops on it.
Mm.
And, not that we sold to all of them, but
right,
certainly hundreds and hundreds of shops.
Wow.
Yep. Huge pain in the ass. Would not recommend it.
So I might be reaching here, but I'm kind of curious. With how the internet has changed things these days, does it kind of feel like you're back in the old days sometimes, trying to get people to pay you cash or just pay for a movie?
It's so different. It's so different. I mean, obviously the landscape, the media landscape has changed in ways that we could never predict. I mean, no crystal ball you could look into back in 2001 could tell you what's going on today.
Right.
And for every opportunity that's been taken away, another one has been created.
Hmm.
Whether or not we've been able to appropriately or efficiently tap into all those opportunities is tough to say.
Hmm.
I think for a large part, we have been able to do that. And that's probably one of the reasons why we're still here, and we're still, at least in 2019, making an annual feature film. The name of the game has just changed. I mean, there was a point in time where you could, your pitch deck to a sponsor included throwing a logo in the intro and shooting with the athletes and sending them a case of 50 DVDs. And they're just like, here's our money. I mean, well, it wasn't that easy, but those are the deliverables that they wanted.
And right. And once you do it a few times and they're in that mindset 10 years ago, I feel like it might just be that easy.
For me, it was never that easy. Okay. I mean, another thing that I will mention that was really hard for me early on,
mm-hmm.
in particular, there were a number of brands back in the early 2000s that were very keen on what was going on in free skiing. And they had a lot of money to spend, and they were down to spend it. And those were the Salomons, the Helly Hansens, the Oakleys. Even mm-hmm. Smith, I think, at that point, fell into that category.
Mm-hmm.
But all of those brands had awesome relationships with Porgboys, TGR, and Mapstick.
Mm-hmm.
And they had no interest in working with me. And again, not being a salesman and not being somebody who's going to, you know, try to throw a wrench in those gears, like I was not going to step in the middle of those relationships. And, you know, that left me in level one picking up the scraps.
Okay.
And there were a lot of six-figure deals early on that were floating these movies and floating these companies.
And floating really nice lifestyles with people behind them.
Holy shit. And never, ever have I seen anything even remotely close to a six-figure partnership contract. Mm-hmm. Not even remotely close. And I was just behind the times. And, you know, I mean, it is what it is, but it always put me in a situation where I had to be super scrappy and figure out how to, you know, engineer these little deals for, you know, $2,500 for $5,000, for ultimately $10,000, or maybe twice that on like the high end mm-hmm. for some of them. And in some cases, like a little bit more, but not a lot. There was never any pot of gold at the end of the rainbow.
Not drinking from the fire hose.
No. And mm-hmm. I mean, it definitely made things challenging. It was also a blessing and a curse, though, because we never overspent mm-hmm. and we never like blew things out or put ourselves in a situation where the disappearance or the termination of a contract or the end of a contract put us in a terrible situation. Because I do know some of these companies that had been, you know, in these multi-year deals that were worth tons and tons of money, that deal is over and does not renew. And all of a sudden it's like, holy shit, what do we do? Like there's $500,000 that we don't have coming in this year. You know, never did I have to deal with anything like that. And so, you know, we had to work a little harder for it and run our show very lean, but we also never got in trouble. And I never got to a point where it was like, oh my God, we're not going to be able to make a movie because we lost a sponsor. Mm-hmm. Like we'd lose sponsors here and there.
Right.
And some, it was really tough to lose, but it would never destroy our business model and never like throw us that far off our game that we couldn't
sure.
figure out where to pick up where we left off.
I was just saying that I think having to run on the margins, like you're saying, and just be scrappy, probably served you rather than running a surplus, spending the surplus, and then having to adjust to Instagram changing everything.
Absolutely, for sure. I mean, I think I've always been scrappy and very conservative in the way that I've run level one, and that is why we are still here. But yeah, I mean, as far as just the changing media landscape, we've had to adopt so much of our practices and how we maintain relationships with our partners and how we do distribution and mm-hmm. how we run promotion. And I think we've done it pretty well, but I'll tell you what, we've had to work so much harder for that same slice of pie
mm-hmm.
because more so than ever before, everybody wants custom content. Everybody has a very long list of specific deliverables that they need for that same contract that you used to get just for shooting with the athletes and putting the logo in the movie.
Because everyone has their own channel now, and you used to be the channel.
Exactly. And I'm fine with producing the content that they want and mm-hmm. giving it to them. The only problem is, again, we're just having to work that much harder for that same piece of pie. There's no like, oh, now that you're also producing this movie and custom content for us, like there's not another dime to be had. So, I mean, that is the challenge. We've had to get more people on board. They have to do more work and margins are slimmer, which is why you know, we continue to try to diversify to keep the business afloat.
Well, I appreciate you going into that, even though it's not related to second generation, because it's fascinating to me, and I think hopefully to a lot of other people. But going back to the past now, you mentioned sitting on your computer downloading, you know, potato quality files to see skiing, and it took me aback that New Schoolers is in the credits, because I mean, I know they go back a long time. I did not know it was 2001, far back.
Yeah.
What was New Schoolers like back then, and how did was the movie received there?
You know, in the early days, the forums were, I think Freeze Magazine had a forum, Poor Boys had a forum. I think New Schoolers was the third person to the party.
Hmm.
And as those other forums kind of dried up and New Schoolers probably put a little more effort into their layout and really focused on making a community platform, which Matt Harvey was very good at doing with a very smooth user interface. I think they kind of like took over that scene, but yeah, I mean, they were definitely on it in 2001, maybe even 2000, I think. And,
were you in the forums? Like,
oh, of course I was.
I got this movie hit on my website to put it to
probably. I think, you know, I've never been one for shameless self-promotion.
Right.
It has never been my shtick, but I probably jumped in there to some extent, and if nothing else, I was...
I mean, that's the community. You got to put it out there to the community.
Absolutely, and if nothing else, I was very actively involved in just, like, reading what was going on, because that's, again, no Facebook. No,
right.
None of the ways that we're all familiar with communicating and sharing things these days, so... You know, if somebody wants to talk about something or share something, like, it was these crazy forums. And New Schoolers was the forum for New School Skiing.
Mm. Did you... There are, I think, a lot more hesitancy now to maybe including someone else's clips in your project. And I guess that's come from the fact that everybody has a camera now, and it's a lot easier to get clips. But... It really strikes me that you were so open to say, yeah, send me your shit. Like, let's put it in the movie. Let's make your part bigger. Let's do it. Was there a thought process there, or was that just a gut feeling? Like, I'm going to do this way.
A little bit of this, a little bit of that. I'll tell you, like, I don't remember caring too much about it either way at the time. I think it was probably coming from the athletes in the context of, I got these cool shots with so-and-so, like, they'll give them to you if you can put them in the movie for me. And it was like, okay, cool. Quality control was not of the utmost importance. I mean,
right.
Clearly, you know, we're shooting on 3-chip, you know, mini DV camcorders. And, you know, I didn't consider myself this super accomplished cinematographer that, you know, this other content didn't belong next to, but yeah, I mean, I also at the same time wasn't, you know, opening the floodgates, because these projects were super personal. It was really just me making the movie, editing the movie. Like, I was level one.
Right.
So, yeah, I mean, there's probably, like I said, maybe 10% of that movie, or probably even a little less, that came from other people, but it was really just for the sake of rounding things out. And I also can say that, you know, this was content coming in that I didn't have the ability or the access to shoot. It was primarily backcountry content from some of the guys that we were really good friends with and we worked with. And, you know, it was like, oh my God, I've got a shot of you know, Alta backcountry. Like, this is crazy. Like, I've heard of that place.
Mm-hmm.
And that was about it. And, yeah, I mean, it's definitely changed a lot over the years. And in fact, you know, one of the things I dislike most about our projects these days is just the number of filmers that we have to get involved in order to cover all our bases and make all our athletes feel like they're getting the attention they deserve.
Hmm.
And in a perfect world, you'd have 2 to 3 filmers out shooting something, because it really allows you to maintain a very specific style of shooting and certainly, you know, editing that content on the back end as well.
And when you do something different, it's because it's deliberately different, not different because it's someone different.
Exactly,
it was just their way.
Exactly, exactly. And it's you know, the blessing and the curse of running such a big crew with so many athletes with so many different interests and styles and
mm-hmm.
goals. And
mm-hmm.
that there's no way that a crew of 2 to 3 filmers could cover it all. And granted, like I, for example, don't travel and film as much as I used to. I'm not gone for 6 months out of the year
mm-hmm.
the way I was a decade ago. But, you know, even if I was filming full time, like there's no way that, you know, a 2 to 3 person film crew could get all that done. And it's awesome because it creates an end product where there's so much diversity of action and
sure.
so much fresh content and so much variety, but you definitely lose a little bit of the feeling that you'd have when one or two people are behind something.
Yeah. And it brings the athletes together more too. If it's smaller and less spread out, I think there's much more of a crew vibe to these older flicks that, for better or for worse, isn't present in
Absolutely.
Current level one movies.
I mean, there was a time where every single person in our crew knew everybody else in the crew, and they would ski together a number of times throughout the year. I mean, I remember our park shoot in Mammoth for Refresh in 2009, where we had maybe close to 15, 18 athletes there, to the point where instead of sled tows, we're all being towed behind a snow cap because that was the only reasonable way to get people up and down the mountain. And I mean, everybody from Tanner Rainville to Henrik Harlow and Phil Casabon and Tom Walsh and Ahmet Dottoli and Duncan Adams and like, you know, all these people who have gone in different directions were at one point going to the same shoots together.
Mm.
And it was a different era.
Mm.
It was definitely a different era. Your Duncan Adams and Tanner Rainvilles don't go to park shoots in 2019 because that's not what they're interested in. And your Phil Casabons and Ahmet's are not going to Alaska,
right?
Or spending their whole season in Canada. Ahmet because he's not allowed. But that's a different story.
Right. So, speaking of some funny shit to loop it back to here at the end, there's some fun stuff in the credits and after the credits that we'll get to. But first in the credits, maybe Garrett Britton, you might have to correct me, rides his bike full speed
into a pond.
Yeah.
So, at that point, I was spending summers living in my parents' farmhouse in southern Vermont. Because they were not there. They were still in New York full time.
Nice.
And that was where I edited most of the first two movies in
mm-hmm.
the loft there. And all the East Coast crew would gather in the summer for a couple days or maybe a couple weeks. I don't remember. Basically just to like look at footage and party.
Mm-hmm.
And we're at the end of a dirt road in the middle of a rural area. There's literally nothing to do but hang out and watch footage and day drink. So that resulted in all kinds of ridiculous stuff going on, not the least of which was Garrett Britton hopping on my dad's Gary Fisher hoo-hoo-hoo mountain bike and just riding it like full steam into the pond. Just like, I wonder what's going to happen when we try this. And I think that was kind of representative of everything that was going on at that point.
Uh-huh.
I wonder what's going to happen when we try this. But yeah, that was that. I think there's also a shot of Ben Gruno at that point. Like just chugging vodka in my parents' kitchen,
uh-huh.
Probably like 1 in the afternoon.
The funny thing about that though is that with a lot of the other stuff you're trying out, there's a scenario in which it works really well. I don't know what the scenario there, the upside is.
No. Well, I think a lot of the stuff that doesn't make the movie and is just like the stupid behind the scenes like nonsense was influenced by what everybody's seeing at that point. It's like Jackass was on the rise or maybe
mm-hmm.
just like had already peaked, and you know, it was just like, let's do stupid shit and put it on tape.
Because we got a video camera now.
Yeah, exactly. That wasn't always the case. Nope. So it was our license to just do things like that. And where there might not have been an upside.
Right.
Yeah.
I love it.
Yep. He got out and he survived. That was the upside.
Mm-hmm. And then gets tabletopped into the pond.
Exactly.
Yeah. We talked about... Well, you actually had to inform me of the bonus feature in Balance, but I got this one. I saw it, and it kind of wish I didn't, but...
it's pretty brutal.
It's really graphic, so don't watch it if you don't have the stomach for some blood and some puncture wounds and some surgery, maybe, but what happened? what was going on there?
Oh, man. So first off, I just got to point out that, back in the day, before DVDs, if you wanted to have some sort of a hidden feature, hidden bonus on a VHS tape, you just had to lay down like 5 minutes of black tape after the end of your credits.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it was the same kind of thing like CDs way back in the day. You could have a quote unquote hidden track by just burying it after either like a 20-minute like blank track, or sometimes artists or labels would do like, dozens of like 5 second tracks. Mm-hmm. So you'd have to like click through the like track number 98 to find some bonus track. But anyway, so we actually had one for Balance and then we want to get it for second generation. Ironically enough, both of those first hidden features were me getting hurt real bad. But that summer we were up in Ottawa. This is actually on September 10th. 2001, because the next day I remember waking up in my friend Garrett Britton's basement, and his dad came down the stairs and said, "Turn on the TV, your country is under attack."
Whew.
Yeah, that was fucking crazy. And side note, my dad actually worked in Manhattan.
I remember, scary.
Yeah, it was. I mean, it was so surreal. But I remember we're all like sitting there and waiting. But anyway, we ended up having to stay in Canada for like 3 or 4 days until they opened the borders.
Wow.
My dad was fine. Everybody was fine. So it was all good. But anyway, so that's how I remember that date so vividly. But we were up there for a Molson Snow Jam, which was like a city quarter pipe event.
Dope.
With the scaffolding and...
there's some clips of that in there,
yeah,
right?
There definitely are, for sure.
Yeah.
And it's actually funny to think now that, we are wrapping up our movie by early September, or there's a problem. And, back then, we're still just, like, nonchalantly shooting. There's, like, no real deadline. It's like, yeah, I'll get the movie done someday. And but anyway, after this event, we went to somebody's house on the Ottawa River, and they had this big wooden ramp and this old piece of crap like a huffy Kmart bike with a bunch of float like milk jugs tied to it, and you just send it off the ramp in the water. And for whatever reason, I did not or was not able to dish the bike. It ended up coming down with my knee right on the handlebars is kind of what I remember. And knowing what I found out shortly thereafter is the brake lever wasn't attached. The brakes were just like there were none. And the brake lever had popped up and gone right through the center of my right joint capsule, just like pierced the damn thing. And I remember swimming to the shore and thinking like,
doesn't feel so good.
No. But I mean, it was kind of like locked up and it felt like somebody just like it hit my knee with a hammer, like that kind of feeling. And I remember climbing out of the water, straightening my leg in this like, just jet stream of blood just went like 15, 20 feet across the yard. And it was like, oh my God. Like, is that a fucking artery? And I remember I took my t-shirt and just wrapped it like basically a tourniquet around my knee. I don't even know if that's a thing, if you can actually put a tourniquet around a knee. But anyway, called 911, ambulance came to get me, and they like
drives into the yard,
drives straight down to the yard, which was like very entertaining for everybody.
Right.
And I mean, it was like semi-serious, like I was kind of scared, but I also wanted to look cool and not show my fear. And anyway, ended up at Ottawa General Hospital, where they definitely had a shortage of staff that night. And I was waiting for hours and hours and hours in this like general like hospital room waiting area. And they do not have an OR that's opened at that point. And so they just send in a doctor, I think, I hope, I don't know for
maybe
sure.
Maybe a nurse, we don't know.
Yep, some dude wearing scrubs.
Right.
Who proceeds to let us know that they need some help. And they put scrubs and rubber gloves on everybody else. As you can see in the hidden feature. And yeah.
See, but I thought you stole those scrubs and put them on as a joke. I did not realize that they were like,
you know,
here, put
if
these
I,
on.
If, actually, I'm going to change my story. If I remember correctly, we were there for so long that there was like a supply shelf and everybody was just like putting the shit on, joking around. But as it turns out, they definitely did not have anybody else. The operating room never opened up. So they ended up having my friends help them clean my knee out. There's one doctor.
I don't know if that's worse for you or your friends, but it's not good. It's not fun for anybody at the moment.
No, it was definitely not fun for anybody. But yeah, I mean, of my two knees, that one's still definitely way better than the other one. So I mean, it's not that big a deal. But highly recommend not puncturing your joint capsule. I mean, it's basically like the equivalent of taking a pencil and just like ramming it through your kneecap all the way through, right into the, yeah, that was bad. Don't do that at home, kids.
Yeah. it's a hilarious story, and it is hard to watch.
It was even harder to edit because one of the reasons I did not become a doctor is because I really don't like blood and I don't like that kind of stuff. And yeah, I remember like needing to like psych myself up to actually like sit there and edit it. When it came time, I was like, all right, here we go.
Oh.
Yeah, not fun. Yeah, they actually ended up like cutting the hole bigger and they like literally stuffed my knee full of gauze. And then they like,
I don't think you're supposed to do that.
No.
I was watching that happen. I was like, not really procedure.
No.
Even as a layman, I know that.
well, I'll tell you what, I think I only got a bill for like $1,000 for the whole thing. So thank you,
Canada.
Yep.
Socialized healthcare. Anything I missed that you want to chat about?
I think that about covers it, but, again, thank you all for joining. If you made it this far, props and high fives.
Mm-hmm.
And we'll see you next week.
Mm-hmm. Thanks for listening. All right. Thank you for tuning in to episode 2 of Level 20. If you somehow listen to this whole pod without watching Second Generation First, go watch it right now on the website, www.level1productions.com. Once again, if you have questions, email those in, podcast@level1productions.com. If you want to support awesome independent filmmaking, go hit the store on the Level 1 website, pick up some fresh threads or one of the new dad hats with the script logo that we just restocked. Pro tip, if you subscribe to the Level 1 newsletter, you can find at the bottom of the homepage, you get 10% off your first purchase. Other ways to support, you can subscribe and review us on Apple Podcasts if that's your platform of choice. You can follow the Level 1 Instagram account @Level1. And you can save up your spare change to get ready to purchase the 20th Level 1 movie, Romance, when it drops this fall. So cheers, thanks for listening, and keep an eye out for the Strike 3 pod dropping next week, and future episodes every Sunday all summer long.